All right, we're going to get going. We have a big day ahead of us here, and an interesting day because we have veterans and farmers in the same room today. So I want you all to behave out in the audience with each other, and we don't usually mix these groups, so I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I hope it goes all right here. So, members, we're gonna change your schedule just briefly. Representative Higer came to my office on his hands and knees this morning, said I gotta go somewhere else. Representative Magnus, I don't know. We can take a vote on whether we can do that or not. But oh, I see. So, but he graciously asked, and we graciously accepted, and said we would do it. So we're gonna move his bill up so he can get out of here. And then we will move into the dairy portion of it, and then we'll finish the day, the last hour or so, with the veterans portion and a number of bills that are before us, and we'll talk about those as we get there. But for right now, we're gonna jump around a little bit. But Representative Higerton has House File 2523, and I would move that House File 2523 is before the committee. For possible inclusion tomorrow in a bill that will move out of here. So we're considering it now, and we'll probably be laying it over, Representative Higerton. But welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
oh, wait a minute. By the way, turn off your cell phones. I'll remind you the rules from last year. If your cell phone goes off, you owe a buck to the coffee pot up here. It's right there. You've got the can. If your cell phone goes off and you answer it, you own $5 to the can, okay? That's the rules in the committee. We'll keep the can right here. And there is coffee up here. I don't know if we got enough for everyone, but if you're thirsty and haven't had a cup of coffee, this is the Ag Committee. Help yourself. The coffee's always on. Representative Higerton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a one-word oral amendment that needs to be included. Line 1.6, put in $2 million, and line 1... 0.12 put in $2 million. And the bill is in order.
I don't have the bill yet here.
Okay.
All right. Say it again, Representative Hager.
Line 1.6 put in $2 million, and then line 1.12 put in $2 million.
All right. Everyone got that? We're adding $2 million in the two blanks on 1.16 and 1.12. The chair will move that amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? That is adopted. Representative Higer.
Okay, last year, Representative Otremba and I, we had a bill that had to do with depleted uranium, and funding was allocated for that. And that was a thought. I'm talking, there are some pictures of the SOC Center facility that we're looking at as a possible a village for treatment of exposure to the depleted uranium. There's only one, for example, in the entire United States, and that's in Baltimore. And right now, Congress is in session, and again, there's a lot of different ideas going and different needs that are going forth. With that, we also discussed a transitional housing or a veteran center that provides, talking to Barry Ball over the administrative center over at St. Cloud, has indicated that there was a need for group counseling. But what I have here, basically, and I've talked to the chair, Chair Hausman, and she says there may be a contingency factor with this bill, but what we are doing is we're pursuing federal legislation right now. Most of the federal legislation that comes forth is an 87% to 13% match. So we are not exactly sure where we're at with any of these numbers, but we want you folks to be familiar with what we do have over at SOC Center. I want to thank the group for being out at SOC Center last year. Representative Junkie, I want to thank you for bringing them out. And most of them were there. For those who were not there, there are some pictures there. With that said, and with the needs that are gone forth down in Washington, D.C., we've been in contact with Chair Filmer, among others. They're very impressed with the facility that we have. We just have to find its niche, and that's what we're working on. But Nancy Gertner's been working with issues in Washington. She flies to and fro, and she's very active in veteran affairs and veterans issues. And I'm going to turn the, we're not going to do a PowerPoint, so you got a handout instead. We're trying to shorten and represent Junkie. It might be nice to get done before in less than 10 minutes, so we're going to do that. All right? Thank you, Mr. Junkie.
Well, thank you, and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Gertner. I live in St. Louis Park, and I'm a veteran of the United States Navy. After touring the facility at Sauk Center, I would advocate using it for transitional housing or for outreach. I think it has the potential to be used for residential retreat center. And for Minnesota helping veterans, I think it's important to look at some statistics. Minnesota does not have an active military base like most of the other states do. And because we do not have an active military base, we do not have some of those facilities and some of those services that many of the other states do, including some of our neighboring states like North and South Dakota that have smaller populations than Minnesota do. A lot of our veterans in Minnesota are National Guard veterans. And an important statistic regarding the National Guard is that the Minnesota National Guard is the sixth largest National Guard in the country. The membership is around 13,000, and 10,000 of those National Guard members have been deployed since 2001, and many of them have been deployed more than once. The National Guard is not entitled to the same benefits that the active military are. And one of the entitlements where there's a big difference is with health care through the Department of Veterans Affairs. President Bush signed a bill just last week that changed the entitlement of the National Guard members to 5 years of health care from the Department of Veterans Affairs because it was previously only 2 years. Many of us know that the National Guard deployment, the contingency that returned last year, about 2,600, was the longest deployment in the history of the National Guard, and that's a 377-year history for their deployment of 22 months. So for those of us that served in the military in the United States Navy, like I did, we're used to deployments being 6 months. And so to have this deployment be 22 months is just, to me, astounding, you know, to think that we can have people away from their families for that length of time. And, of course, I don't think that this comes without a cost. And it's hard to quantify what those costs are, and it's hard to know what they are until some of them show up. So I guess what I wanted to do today is I wanted to focus on what I call the extremes. And this is what happens when some veterans get to the end of their cliff. Post-traumatic stress disorder is something that affects many veterans. And a recent article published in the New York Times indicated that the estimate for National Guard members is that half of them report mental health problems. So we can easily calculate for Minnesota what half of 10,000 veterans is that have been deployed. So I wanted to look a little bit on the homicide and the suicide statistics, because you being the Finance Committee need to look at, do we need to do anything? What happens if we don't do anything? And if we do something, how much do we want to spend? How much can we spend? Last week, when Representative Paymar talked at Second Chance Day on the Hill, he said that the state budget for the annual operation of prisons in the state of Minnesota is $335 million. The New York Times article that they did, they focused on homicides committed by veterans. And they found that the number of homicides committed by veterans was greater in the last 6 years than it was in the 6 years prior to veterans being deployed prior to Afghanistan in 2001. Of those 121 homicides that were looked at, Minnesota had one red dot on the map for one of those 121. And coincidentally, that red dot in Minnesota was right by Sauk Center. In looking at suicides, we have interesting statistics from Vietnam veterans. And this is a quote from Representative Filmer, who chairs the House Veterans Affairs Committee. And he says that the number of suicides among Vietnam veterans now exceeds the number that died in combat, and that is over 58,000. It's harder to quantify cost of suicide on a state. I guess homicides, we could calculate the cost more because local governments end up prosecuting the perpetrator of homicides in the courtroom, and those are costs that we can quantify. With suicides, the numbers are estimates because there's not a lot of tracking that's done on this. And so the estimates are 1,000 suicides per veterans that are receiving health care through the Department of Veterans Affairs, and 5,000 per year among all living veterans. A year ago, there was action in the federal Congress, and there was a bill that was ultimately passed and signed by President Bush just before Veterans Day last year in November. And it's one of the copies in your handouts. It's the Joshua Omvig Veterans Suicide Prevention Act. And it tasks the Department of Veterans Affairs with doing several things to prevent veteran suicide. What it does not do is it did not provide funding for them for that, because it said that a lot of the things passed in this bill were things that they were going to be doing or were supposed to be doing by the end of the year. One of the things that it tasks is training for their staff people, and it also gives them an outreach mission as part of their suicide prevention. My personal opinion is that it's hard to do outreach activities in a clinical environment of a Veterans Affairs Medical Center. And so it's my belief that this facility at Fox Center could provide for opportunities for doing outreach that would make it easier for the Department of Veterans Affairs to reach veterans that might need help, specifically needing help with mental health issues. And the Fox Center facility is conveniently located within 40 miles of the Veterans Affairs Medical Center at St. Cloud, where they have beds for doing inpatient psychiatric treatment. In California is a facility called Veterans Village San Diego, which is also featured in your handout. This is a facility that started in 1981 with five Vietnam veterans that decided that they needed to do something to help Vietnam veterans. They got a $10,000 grant from the mayor of San Diego, and they started Veterans Village. And it's been very successful, and research done has shown that it's the most successful type of model for dealing with homeless veteran populations. And San Diego decided they needed to do something because the city of San Diego had the largest veteran homeless population. They discovered that 40% of their homeless people in San Diego were military veterans. The reason for that probably being that there's a Navy base in San Diego, and there were also Marines that were discharged and ending up homeless in San Diego. And part of this could be because some of these veterans that were discharged probably received discharges that were other than honorable. So the military was getting rid of their problem sailors and their problem Marines. They were discharging them for personality disorders or other reasons, and they were ending up out in the street in San Diego, and they were homeless. And the city had a problem, and that is what they did to deal with their homeless veterans population in San Diego. And it's been very successful, and some veterans credit the program with saving their life. And they have a good statistic for their results. They say that over 75% of the graduates a full year after graduation are clean and sober. They have life-sustainable incomes, or have increased life-sustainable income, have created no new crime, and are paying required child support, which is another statistic, of course, that we can measure in government, and no nights homeless, which, of course, is important to us in Minnesota, especially when the nights are as cold as they were last night. And I guess for my final comment, what I want to do is I want to reiterate a veteran last year when I talked at a meeting told me, he said, you know, because I'm elderly and I'm not going to go to school and use my GI Bill, there's only one veteran's benefit that's useful for me now, and that is being buried in a national cemetery. And I think that's kind of sad when that's the only benefit that our veterans feel that they're entitled to as a result of their uniform service to their country. And there is one other benefit that veterans are entitled to, and it fits in a paper bag, and so I brought one along with me today to share with you. And this is it. It's a folded piece of cloth. You can see it has 50 stars. It has 13 stripes. And I think that every veteran, whether they die by natural causes or by suicide, is entitled to one of these. And when it's presented to the family members at the funeral, the chaplain or the uniformed person making the presentation gives it to a family member along with six words. And those six words are, on behalf of a grateful nation. And so my question today is, are we grateful, we the people in the state of Minnesota, and are we grateful enough to do something for our Minnesota veterans and using resources within the state of Minnesota? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, very good, and we appreciate those comments and your presentation, and it's right on the mark. And I will point out to members that I know I've had contact with Ms. Gertner many times, and she does a wonderful job of trying to track what's going on in Washington for us. Because, again, I think that's one of the keys to this project is securing some Washington funding. Obviously, it's a large facility. We were up there on our ag tour, if you remember, those members that were on the ag tour. It was an Ag and Veterans tour because we went up to this facility and rode the golf carts around that day, and it was a beautiful day and it was a nice outing. But we did realize what kind of an asset we may still have there, and we will get into it later, obviously, and continue. But we need updates from you on where you're at in Washington and what's going on, and hopefully we can find a use for that facility in the future, because it is something that should be utilized by somebody. So we appreciate your time, and Representative Heigerken, anything else?
Thank you, Chair Duncan, and thank you, members.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. May I add one other thing?
Yep.
There are states that are trying to do facilities, a Veterans Village, for example, in North Carolina, and they are trying to do it as a nonprofit, and they are trying to raise over $100 million because they are starting from the ground up and they have nothing but a piece of land. And so if they have to buy the land and build the buildings, the fundraising over $100 million is really quite a lofty goal.
Right. Yep. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Heigerken. House File 2523 will be laid over for possible inclusion in a upcoming bill. All right. We're going to move now into the dairy portion of the day. Yeah. First up, we have Assistant Commissioner Robin Kinney is on the way. We're going to get a little update on the dairy industry, and then we have Minnesota Association of Co-ops and a couple growers, I understand, will come up. Then we'll take a look at the livestock investment grant bill that we had in policy yesterday to get that at least onto the table here in the committee and visit about it. So. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Representative Junkie, Chairman Junkie, and committee members. My name is Robin Kinney, and I am an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Started in the position in early September, and my oversight is for the non-regulatory division. It is my pleasure to be with you today to bring you up to date on the dairy industry. Seated to my right is Quinn Cheney, who is the Director of Policy Development for both the Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health. We do have some exciting news in the dairy industry, and just to recap a little bit of where our stand is, obviously this committee knows that agriculture is big business in Minnesota. In fact, we are the sixth largest agricultural producer in the United States. Of that, $9.3 billion in cash receipts, livestock accounts for just over half of that total, or $4.9 billion, and the dairy and cattle and calves industry accounts for nearly one-fourth of that total, or $2.3 billion price tag. We currently rank sixth in the U.S. for the number of dairy cows in milk production. We're the fifth largest agricultural exporting state in the U.S., with dairy products accounting for $83 million worth, and that compares to just $13 million in 1990. The snapshot of the Minnesota dairy industry also includes dairy farms with cows now sitting at 4,950, a decline of almost 250 dairy farms from a year ago, and about 400 if we would track back to 2005. Minnesota has 463,000 cows, 8,000 more than a year ago, with about 91 cows on each of our farms, and that's an increase of 2 to 5 head over the past several years. One statistic that is used to measure success in the dairy industry is the average production per cow, and right now that's sitting at about 18,000 pounds of milk, an increase of 2% over a year ago. Many people are aware of the increased milk prices at record levels in this past year to make up for several years of deficit, but so are feed prices, which account for about 45% of production costs. The important ratio of milk price to feed cost continues to narrow, which is impacting the dairy farmers' profitability. As a department, we continue to promote ourselves in Great Places to Dairy and where dairy farmers gather, including World Dairy Expo, the Central Plains Dairy Expo, and the Midwest Dairy Expo in Sioux Falls. The Minnesota Dairy Profit Teams have also developed a website to try to link those interested in dairy farming in the state by connecting them with existing dairy operations and help serve in the transition of the next generation of dairy farmers. Recently, the Department of Agriculture has also had the ability to expand our livestock development team by hiring Jim Osley, a former feedlot officer from Sandy Hook County, to be able to come on and assist producers as they navigate the permitting process and transitions of farms and helping them make their facilities up to date. Today, we're also aware that bovine tuberculosis will be an issue, and Ms. Cheney is ready here to answer any questions on that. But we would like to say that the dairy industry looks good today. We're making up for some past losses that we've had. We're working together to be able to transition the next generation in. We are bringing new breeders and new dairy farmers to the state of Minnesota in an effort to make sure that our dairy industry remains strong and consistent. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. We're going to have an update on the bovine TB tomorrow in this committee and where we're at and where we're going and what all the different designations mean. So you can prepare for that tomorrow. Ms. Cheney, you got anything you want to add about dairy? Do you drink milk? Do you eat cheese? Huh?
Of course.
All right. All right. Any questions for the department on the dairy industry and their role in it? By the way, I'm glad you hired some from Candy Eye County. That's always a good thing, we think.
We knew you'd be pleased.
You think so too, right?
Yes.
Our CA is from Candy Eye County also. Any questions? All right, very good. I want to know, there's something sitting there. Wally, did you bring something in, or is there something?
There's yogurt available for all the committee members.
Okay. If the pages would bring the yogurt around and anyone who wants it, and then whatever's left over, you know, start with the commissioner and the big shots in the front row over here, and then anyone else that wants. Again, this is the Ag and Veterans Affairs Committee, so when you people come in, feel free to bring food or treats or anything else. We have no problem with that here. So I don't think the sergeant's office is in here, so we're okay. David Ward? And your folks, come on up. If the pages would grab them, one more chair up there, too. Arlen, can you get one more chair up there? They have three people. Now we're going to hear what's going on out in the country, and... we have the director, Minnesota Association of Co-ops. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself. We have a tape rolling, and that's why, so we can identify the voices, and then proceed with your presentation.
Okay, I'm David Ward. I'm the dairy director with the Minnesota Association of Co-ops, and we're a statewide trade association representing the co-op interests in Minnesota, and I think most of you know that We're very proud of our cooperative heritage here in the state of Minnesota. We're the number one cooperative state in the country, and included in that are many dairy cooperatives. And with me here today, I have two of our producer members who ship milk to Minnesota cooperatives, and Steve Slingen and John Funk, and I'll let them tell the story. I think we're focusing today on the importance of the Dairy Investment Grant Program. And what that will do for them as Minnesota dairy producers to help modernize their facilities.
Good. And for members' information, we do have the Livestock Investment Grant Bill that we're going to be hearing, so they're going to be speaking to that. It's in your folder. Some of you heard it yesterday in policy. The bill isn't physically before us. It's going to be transferred on the floor to us, but we wanted to hear it since it's dairy here, and so you do have the bill in the folder. And I would also add, for those of you that don't know, Mr. Ward is a former legislator from Wisconsin, our neighbors next door. So
guilty as charged.
If you want to bang on him for any of that type of thing, or Wisconsin competing with us on dairy or whatever, it's probably his fault, because he did a lot of good things for dairy, I know, when he was over there. And he's a dairy farmer and owns a farm out there in Wisconsin. So we know you know what you're talking about, and we appreciate that. So welcome to the committee. Introduce yourselves. Get near a mic there and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for allowing us to be here today. My name is Steve Slungen. I farm with my wife Cheryl and I have four children. We milk about 70 cows and run about 250 acres of land just south of Albany up in central Minnesota. I serve on the board of directors of AMPI and represent dairy on the MAC Council, and I'm also a member of Minnesota Milk Producers Association. I hope you've all gotten copies of our dairy initiative. If you haven't, you probably will sometime today. I'll try not to go over them individually due to time restraints. We all understand that our economy is somewhat slow, but there are sectors of our economy that I believe have a great deal of potential. Our dairy industry is one of those sectors. Keep in mind that our livestock industry supplies 20% of the jobs in this state. The dairy industry is a big part of that. Any steps we can take to help the dairy industry, whether at the farm level with controlling regulations, promoting expansions and modernizations, or at the plant level controlling transportation costs or helping plants be more efficient, will result in more efficiencies and more economic returns to our state. The agricultural economy has changed dramatically in the last year and a half. A year and a half ago, corn was $1.70 a bushel. Now it's pushing $5 a bushel. Beans were $4.80. Now futures indicate $13 to $14 a bushel. I believe these higher prices make the Midwest more competitive across the country for producing milk. And it's going to be up to this state if we want to be friendly to dairy and promote it, or if Iowa, Wisconsin, and the Dakotas will be more attractive for added production. We have the renewable fuel industry expanding up here, and dairy is a perfect fit to use up their byproducts, while at the same time protecting our environment by using less chemicals and fertilizers to produce our feed supply. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Junkie and committee members. My name is John Funk. I'm a dairy producer in central Minnesota. Along with my four sons and some hired help, we have about 500 cows. Along with Minnesota Milk, I also represent the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives, as David indicated, the statewide organization representing Minnesota cooperative community. Our state is home of 1,000 cooperative businesses who own more than 3.4 million, owned by more than 3.4 million citizens. 90% of the milk produced in Minnesota is shipped through cooperatives. As David stated, we're number one cooperative in the country, Minnesota is. We are requesting your support for the Dairy Investment Grant Program. This grant program would help Minnesota dairy producers with expenses related to modernizing our dairy facilities. The average Minnesota dairy facility was last built or significantly modernized in 1965, while the average age of a California dairy facility is less than a decade old. While we have extremely capable dairy producers in our state, we are asking them to compete with other major milk-producing regions while shouldering the disadvantages of inefficient, outdated facilities. You can now take the bold step forward to show support for the Dairy Investment Grant Program, which will create an effective tool in helping encourage our dairy producers to renew aging facilities and equipment. A dairy investment grant would send an important signal to the state's dairy producers that our state wants to be a partner in bringing about success for those producers wishing to modernize or expand. This tax credit would help stimulate the kind of reinvestment in our dairy industry so dearly needed to remain competitive in a global marketplace. I feel it's very important that those farms that are passed on are given some tools that they can work with when they pass their farm on to their son or daughter, whichever it may be. We also believe it's important for Minnesota to offer similar tools to those offered by our neighboring states, as Representative Junkie alluded to. Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle signed a similar measure into law in March of 2004 after the legislature received broad bipartisan support. According to the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture Trade and Commission Protection, over $500 million of improvements have been made by Wisconsin dairy producers. In 2007, Wisconsin milk production reached a 17-year high. That was done by the what they review as the 10% investment grant program or investment tax credit program, and I believe Minnesota at this time is taking a little bit of a turn in supporting the grant program. And I'm here to speak to the support of the grant program as related over here. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members, to this group? Again, do you have any numbers in Wisconsin, any of you, especially the legislator, how much money they've put through so far on the their livestock and their dairy investment tax credit?
The first year of the full credit, there was $13.1 million that they attributed that the cost of the credit would be. Now that's $13.1 million of tax collections the state didn't collect because of the tax credit. Now it's a carry forward credit, so it's kind of hard to relate how much investment was or how much, you know, if they would carry forward, you know, the provision and have more credits available in out years. I think after the first 3 years of it, it's probably close to a couple $100 million in credits that it's generated. So it's been very successful, and like was mentioned earlier, represents about $500 million of investment made on the farm.
And did they do anything, didn't they do something last fall or last year to, in addition to this, like a phase two, was it dealing with processing, or was it, I'm trying to think, I remember reading the article.
We did two things. We expanded the credit to livestock, so all livestock, producers get the similar credit, and then fortunately or unfortunately, the increased milk supply has caused a strain on the processing industry. So in the governor's next generation agriculture plan and in the last state biennial budget, they are working on similar kinds of programs to help the processing industry modernize. So the milk is made into dairy products like yogurt and instead of being put on a truck and sent down the road.
Okay, very good.
And that's our hope, that we can have similar successes here in Minnesota.
Our hope too. All right, thank you very much. I've got Minnesota milk producers. Come on down. Welcome. I think as you introduce yourself, you'll be introducing yourself as the new president, I believe. So welcome the committee, and please introduce yourself, and we'll proceed.
Well, thank you, Chairman Junkie. It's a pleasure to be here today on the behalf of Minnesota milk producers. I hope all of you are enjoying your healthy snacks this morning, your yogurt snacks. I'm here to, again, as some of the others before me have done, help present the state of the dairy industry in Minnesota in 2008. I'm Pat Luneman. As Chairman said, I'm the new president of the Minnesota Milk Producers. My wife, Jody, along with our five sons and one daughter, have a dairy farm in Todd County in Representative Trimba's district. And I have a number of things that I like to do. I coach basketball. I sing in a men's chorus, work with the milk producers, and in my spare time, well, we try to get the cows milked, along with the help of a few employees. I want to tell you that dairying in Minnesota is coming back. As Robin Kinney stated to you before, we have more cows now than we had last year. She said 8,000 more. We have 13,000 more than we had 3 years ago. And why is that occurring? It's because dairy producers are making changes to their operations. They're putting in new parlors because they're tired of having sore knees and tired backs. So we're seeing parlors of all types on our farms, from low-cost swing parlors to large rotary parlors to now we're even seeing some fully automated, computerized, the cows go milk themselves type parlors that are coming in. So it's really amazing what's starting to happen. And farmers are also making changes for their cows to make cows happier and more comfortable by putting in compost barns and changing how the freestalls are in their barns from hard mats to deep compost and sand bedding. And then also we have the folks that are amongst our midst that are doing rotational grazing and doing organic to the full-size commercial. And within Minnesota Milk Producers, we support all types of producers in our industry. We want all of them to be successful. Now, we've had success in our industry lately, but we do have some challenges. With the high cost of oil and other energies, it's having a ripple effect in our dairy and agricultural economy. We've got feed costs that are skyrocketing, the fuel and supplies, everything that comes on a truck costs more than it did a year ago. And for Minnesota, this could either be a tremendous opportunity to bring the cows home, as was stated earlier, bring them back from the west, or it could be a major challenge in that our producers will say, you know, dairying is kind of tough to do and there's so many challenges, maybe it's just easier to raise crops. So, you know, I'm challenging the state of Minnesota to help us to make this an opportunity to bring the cows home. Now, in order for dairy to thrive in Minnesota, here are some things that I believe we need to do. The state needs to foster an environment that is healthy and inviting for our dairy industry. Well, there's two ways of helping and creating that environment. On the one hand, you can help promote the industry, like some of the bills that are in front of the committee can do. Or maybe it's possibly by some of the things that you don't do that actually will hurt our industry. You know, if we have over-regulation or layers with bureaucracy, so think about that. Sometimes the things you don't do that will actually help us. To give you an example, you know, most dairy farmers live on the land where they milk their cows. We breathe the same air, we drink the same water that our cows do. And the one little problem is that our forefathers, our grandfathers, when they built their barns, where did they build them? They built them right next to the stream and the pond. Why did they do that? Because it was access to water. And now as we look at modernizing our facilities, we need to make some changes, either move our facilities or make changes so that we can help clean up our air and water. And so, you know, we're asking you to help us with that process. Rather than strap us with new fees, as this year we're learning that Minnesota Pollution Control is coming up with a schedule of new fees for feedlot owners, you know, that's not going to help us. The permitting process needs to be more concise and orderly and so that we can modernize our facilities. And things like that are things that are important to make sure industry thrives. Now, priorities for Minnesota milk producers We have a number of policy and resolutions, and I'd like to share some of those with you today. Number one on my list is cost share funding. We'd like it to be uniform across the state. It used to be that way. Now it's been changed so that it's only in the impaired waters regions. But we feel that dairy farmers across Minnesota, regardless of where they're at, should have access to these funds so that they can get their operations modernized and changed and cleaned up. Dairy environmental review and siting of facilities. I'm going to read our resolution to you so that you understand exactly where we're at in this. We believe that we should establish a permitting process in Minnesota that maintains high regulatory standards to preserve our natural environment while providing rural landowners and state and local officials with a clear and consistent process for siting livestock facilities. In that resolution, we're stating we want to help clean up the environment, but we'd like to work together with you in doing that. The Dairy Investment Grant. You heard previously the success that it's had in the state of Wisconsin. We'd like to have that same success here in Minnesota. Dairy Research Teaching and Consumer Education Center. And here we're talking about the University of Minnesota. We believe that it's time to have a new research facility in Minnesota that is probably outside of the metro area and have a facility that will again make the university, let's bring it back to the standards that it used to be, where we have a university that's leading our agricultural institution in Minnesota. And we think the time is right for that. We know that right now the University TFANS is conducting a study, and Minnesota Milk has been part of that study. And we're hoping that they will see the light and will convince the higher powers at the university of the need for change. And then, of course, we all of us in Minnesota, not just the university, the governor, the legislature, but the industry itself needs to come together to make this happen. State funding for wastewater treatment. Our infrastructure isn't quite what it needs to be. I know of at least two of our milk processing plants that would like to expand their capacity, but they can't because of the wastewater restrictions. They can't add any more wastewater to the stream, and we need to have some help in that respect so that in our communities where our processing facilities are, that we can have the growth that we need to help our industry and our economy. Also, our road infrastructures. You know, this may not be the committee, it should be the transportation committee, but you know, you're all legislators. It's important that we have decent roads in our state, roads and bridges. There was a possibility of getting a new processing plant in Minnesota, and I can't mention any names, but one of the things that is discouraging them from coming here is our road infrastructure. They don't think that in the next 50 years we'll have the capacity to transport the milk to where it needs to be. Short term, one of our resolutions is exempting milk trucks from spring road restrictions. On many of our dairies, when the milk truck comes to the farm, it comes empty, and when it leaves, it's fully loaded. And if we can't fully load the truck in the spring, that leaves a partial tank of milk, and that goes against some of the other regulations that we have, that the milk tanks need to be emptied when the truck leaves. So we have some conflict there that we need to resolve, and we think to have an exemption for spring on milk trucks would be a great idea. Healthy choices in schools. I'm speaking to the choir this morning because all of you are interested and want to promote ag, but we need to promote healthy choices in schools, and dairy would be part of that. One other thing is that dairy farmers are struggling with labor availability and quality. It's a huge issue for us on farms, and Minnesota Milk believes, and I'm going to take this to the immigration word here, Minnesota Milk believes that this is a national issue, and that we believe that immigration reform needs to be made, that there are issues There are problems. It's broken, but it needs to be fixed on a national level. Our dairy farms, our cows, and our people are important to the economy. And it's not just the economy, it's the land and the people. We're all part of a social fabric that we have, that we've seen growing up, those of us in our small towns, and we'd like to keep it to where dairy is a part of that, where it's part of our culture and it's part of our economy, so that our next generations can be there and thrive. And we just hope that all of you legislators will support us in our industry and hope that we have a greater future ahead of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Luneman. And Mr. Mergen, right?
Yes.
Please introduce yourself and any additional comments you might want to add, and then we'll move on to the next testifiers. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Mergen. I own and operate a dairy near Avon, Minnesota, with my wife, Jane, and my two sons, Eric and Joseph. We also have three daughters in our family. We are members of Minnesota Milk Producers Association, Minnesota's grassroots dairy farmer organization. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of the Livestock Investment Grant Program. If passed, it would have a positive impact on Minnesota's dairy industry, our local communities, our state, and our environment. I'm going to give you a little history of our farm. I'm sort of like the poster child here today. We started farming in 1977. We took over the family dairy farm, which is 178 acres, from my parents. We started milking with 33 milk cows in an old stanchion barn, which was a two-story barn, which was very, very labor-intensive. In 1983, I built a new tie stall barn, and it was designed for 44 cows. It was quite an improvement, quite labor savings. I only had to do 8 hours of work a day myself. It was quite an improvement. 4 years ago, wanting to bring in a fifth generation, our sons Joe and Eric, we built a freestall barn for 100 cows. We invested a little over $100,000, and we did most of the labor ourselves. I was a former carpenter, and my son actually was a carpenter too. The result of the new Hope Barn building had a tremendous positive effect on our cows. Our cows are more comfortable, and as a result, they are giving more milk. In addition, it has cut our feeding time in half. We went from a herd average of 21,000 pounds per cow, and we're right now averaging 24,000 pounds per cow. We are in the process of forming a partnership with our two sons, officially transitioning the business to the next generation. We are a Century Farm in 1889. This summer, we are going to convert our tie barn milking stall barn into a milking parlor at a cost of approximately $50,000 to $75,000 using used parlor equipment. We are doing this in part because I had a partial knee replacement. Since that time, I have milked sparingly. I'm looking forward to putting the fun back into milking again. I love milking cows. The other main reason is for labor savings. We will cut our milking time approximately in half by doing this. Our future plans include a new heifer facility to meet the feedlot regulations by 2010, which will cost approximately $75,000. Again, we plan on doing most of the work ourselves. The Livestock Investment Grant Program would benefit us by helping us to reduce our financial burden by approximately $15,000 on a $150,000 investment. One possible scenario, we could consider using this $15,000 to purchase more heifers to increase our freestall barn capacity, and would help significantly increase the return on our investment. Like other dairy farmers, I rely heavily on numerous local vendors such as the Cold Spring Co-op, Famous Feeds for Feed, Russ Fisher, our nutritionalist, for putting together our ration. We also rely on the Cold Spring Vet Clinic, Stearns Vet Outlet, and Mills Fleet for supplies. Our banking is done locally. Our milk gets processed just down the road at Painesville. We are thankful that we have numerous equipment dealers in Stearns County, everything from tractors, forage equipment, milking equipment, TMR mixers. Quality equipment suppliers are the heart and soul of every dairy farm. My situation may be different than the next producer, but the good part about this legislation is that it has the possibility of helping every dairy producer regardless of where they are in their business plan. The benefit goes beyond helping the farmer succeed. It helps the vet, it helps the feed store, the dairy supply store, the construction material supplier, and so on. It translates into kids in our rural schools and people in our towns. Investment grants will help farmers grow their business, which makes a greater Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I strongly urge you to pass the Livestock Investment Grant Program offered by Representative Junkie. It is good for the dairy industry, good for rural Minnesota. It is good policy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Looks like we're good. I appreciate the comments. If you could provide the committee with a list, and I assume you will if we don't have it here, of those items that you'd like addressed over the next year or two legislatively. And I will tell you, at 4 o'clock today, for those that are around in Transportation Committee, we'll be taking care of that dairy haulers road restriction. Magnus will be supporting us on that over there. Yep. So, with that, all right, we have one more, Paul Sobieski and Dave Manor. Thank you. And again, members, we've got about 5 more minutes on this, and we're going to move rapidly into our friends over here that are waiting on the Veterans Home stuff. And we will bring back the Livestock Investment Grant Bill at a future date to do the amendments, because again, we don't physically have a bill. So those that are thinking they want to do amendments or anything like that, just save them, keep the powder dry, and we'll be talking about that in a future meeting when we actually physically have the bill. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. We got about 5 minutes per speaker here, and you're up, and I think you're the finale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Representative Junkie, for bringing this bill forward, for including all livestock, and also for obviously bringing dairy back, because that's very important in terms of moving forward in terms of our state. We think you brought a very good bill forward. We hope that perhaps there might be a couple places maybe to enhance the bill, for example, in terms of setting a lower minimum amount, and also for including pasture development. With that, I'd just like to turn the testimony over to Dave Manar.
And Mr. Manar, for those of you that went on the dairy trip this last summer, we were out at his ranch south of the Twin Cities, and some of the best ice cream we've ever had was served out on that farm, I think. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, committee members, Dave Manar from New Prague, my wife and family. We operate Cedar Summit Farm. I'd like to thank Representative Junkie and the other members that were able to come there. Also, like to thank you for attending our family farm breakfast this morning over at across the street at the church. I was appreciate seeing many of you there. I think this is a great bill, a great move forward with a couple of maybe small changes. I think we need to lower that, maybe that cap at $40,000. I think that's a little steep. I personally know a couple of dairy farmers that have done small improvements to their milking facilities and put parlors into old tie stall barns. We did that years ago on a little larger scale, but I know some of these guys doing all the work themselves could do it for $5,000. So I think we need maybe lower that cap a little bit. And then the other thing is the pasture development. I know I consider pasture development investment just like if you were going to build a building to house cows or anything else. It's an investment that needs to be, it's a long-term thing, and the cost of feed, that's a kind of a permanent, there's a lot of benefits, conservation benefits in grazing like we do, where you're not rotating and tilling the soil. So I think those kind of things, if they were added into the bill, I think it would be a great benefit. So.
Okay. Very good. Any questions, members? And we will be looking at that de minimis. Obviously, last year we set it without really having any facts or figures, but we've been gathering information the last 2 days from folks, and we appreciate that input on the true cost if someone can maybe convert an operation for a long-term effect. So, all right. Thank you very much.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It. And like I say, we will lay this bill over. It's really not before us, and we'll talk about it later. So I want to thank again all the dairy folks in the room for coming, and enjoy your day on the Hill. And the committee, again, thank you for the yogurt treats, and just rest assured that you are amongst friends here. We understand how important the dairy industry is, and we look forward to working with you all in the future. All right. Now, we are going to move on, members, if we could get the commissioner or deputy commissioner up here first. Members, here's what we're doing. And this is a committee, and anything we do out of here is committee-wise. Let me just give you an update on how we're going to proceed. What we have before us today are all the bills that were sent to our committee that are dealing with bonding and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Those bills are due out by Friday to the bonding committee. Obviously, we meet today and tomorrow, so for us, tomorrow. We have a number of options, and I will lay them out. I want you to think about it as we go through the testimonies here. Tomorrow we will put together one bill and send up with whatever we want to send up to them. Okay? Our options are this. After we hear the bills, look at them for technical changes and questions, we can make the decision to simply roll them all into one bill and send them up, saying they all have merit, they all, you know, should get a second shot up at the bonding committee, et cetera, and we'll send them up to Representative Hausman's committee. That'd be option number one. Option number two would be to look at them, and then as a committee, somehow figure out if we want to rank them in an order, 1, 2, 3, 4, et cetera, and send them all up with a ranked order, which is kind of what the former Veterans Home Board did with their projects, but we have more than that now. And we could score them 1, 2, 3, and we could add them up tonight, and they could put the bill together, Colby, about midnight, and then we can, he'd do it in the morning, I'm sure. But we could do that if that's what you want to do. The third option would be to hear the bills and just send up the ones that we think should be sent up, where some maybe go by the wayside. So I want you to think about that. From my standpoint, it doesn't matter to me. I wish we had more time, but we don't. To really, get in depth. I have seen all the projects personally because I'm on the bonding committee. So I've been in the buildings and I've seen the projects that the department brings forward. However, I have not seen some of the Thiessen and the Ward and some of these that are coming now. So again, that's what I'll be asking you after the next 45 minutes here, how you want to proceed on that. And again, the easiest thing is number one, just put them all in unless we have a real objection. But we can certainly, if you want to take the time, then I would have to give you, you could take the materials with you, you could talk to people, you could work on it. But by the end of the day, we'd have to have your ranked order back as an individual, and then we put the bill together based on that. So think about how you want to proceed. Welcome to the committee. The commissioners here, the dual commissioners, I believe, will quickly go through what the former Veterans Homes Board had put together. Now, again, remember, this goes back a ways. That group has been dissolved, and all the responsibilities are now over here at Department of Veterans Affairs. So they didn't write the narratives. They really didn't do the rankings on them initially. But certainly they're the ones that are in those buildings now and can, I guess, just talk briefly on those issues. And members, you have all the handouts from the bonding books that we have in bonding committee in your folders on these projects. So the first page you see is actually the agency priority. They have 10 projects, and they've ranked them in their priority as far as the old homes board. And then there's narratives of all those projects underneath them. So you can literally read about them in depth if you would like. So welcome to the committee, and proceed in a efficient manner.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Drunkie. My name is Clark Dyrud, Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. And as Chair Drunkie alluded a lot changed last November. November 19th, the Veterans Homes Board was dissolved, and the Veterans Homes were moved under the Department of Veterans Affairs. We now have two deputy commissioners. The one that you're familiar with is sitting in the audience, Mike Pugliese. He's our deputy commissioner for Veterans Programs. We have a new deputy commissioner sitting here, Gil Acevedo, that many of you have already met. He is the deputy commissioner for health care. He is equivalent to what used to be called the executive director for the Veterans Homes Board. So the five Veterans Homes answer to Gil. He has experience for 7 years with California Veterans Homes. So he, and is a 20-year Navy veteran. In the interest of time, we will cut to the chase. We understand that you have limited time and a lot to present. We are going to present just the bonding request this year.
And well, do the, you know, you'll do, obviously, the governor's bill had, I think, asset preservation. It had Minneapolis, had a piece of, had an old Silver Bay project, actually.
We will be presenting, we have the bulleted presentation that has been passed around, and I will, he's been here 5 or 6 weeks now. I lose track of time. It moves so quickly, but we will move to Deputy Commissioner Gil Acevedo to move through the bulleted list.
Good morning, Chair Junkie, members of the committee. My name is Gil Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Health. As outlined in the presentation that we have before you, we have a total of a $42.06 million request for 2008 bonding. The request that we have addresses different areas. First one I'd like to discuss is the asset preservation. That's a $7 million request for the department-wide asset preservation for all five facilities. In this request, we're looking at areas that can be areas of buildings or the veterans' homes that need to be repaired beyond the daily maintenance needs of each facility. And it's broken down by Minneapolis, Hastings, Laverne, Silver Bay, Fergus Falls as well. For previous appropriations for this particular project or request, we had a $6 million in 2006 bonding and a $4 million in 2005. The other area I'd like to discuss is the Building 9 demolition. This is a $1 million demolition project of Building 9. The building was built in 1937 with a post and beam design. In October of 2007, during an inspection, we found that the building sections, the lateral beams and horizontal beams, were starting to decay or to rust. During that inspection, we found that the building was not safe, and we decided to move the residents from that building to Building 17. The building was then condemned, and we found that it would be an estimated cost of about $13.3 million to repair the building as is. The decision was made that it would be more cost-effective to demolish the building and then look at a different type of a building to be constructed for a more of a resident-centered care area. The next request, the next slide, talks about that new concept of a new building for the Minneapolis home. Keep in mind that normally when we put in a request for a new facility for a veteran's home, there is a one-third match that the state would come up with, and the United States Department of Veterans Affairs would have a two-thirds match, or a 55% grant that would help with the building. Here we are requesting $25.9 million to build this facility, which will be the full 100% cost. The reason for that is that there is a urgency. We moved residents from Building 9 that were domiciliary residents into Building 17 that are now currently occupying skilled nursing beds. So we need to try to free up those beds. We're also looking at enhancing the quality of life of our veterans there in Minneapolis. The new 100-bed facility is more of a community style, which is neighborhoods. More of a 16 residents per pod or per neighborhood structure. It will enhance or improve the transfer of residents, bathing and other care technologies. We're also looking at improving the living and dining areas for the residents. The next request will be the Silver Bay This request was approved in 2006. Bonding, what has happened here is that the facility is looking to renovate the existing space and more structural building addition, again, to provide better quality care for our veterans at this veterans home. It removes the employees from the area that we are now looking at adding additional resident centers type facility type care. This was approved in 2006. It's been on the waiting list. It's currently 37 on the waiting list. What has happened here is due to the cost of living increase as it's going along, we need an additional $227,000 to keep that one-third match from the state. Next request is a HVAC upgrade for the Minneapolis home. HVAC is a heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. We're asking $7.8 million for this upgrade. The ventilation system during extreme warm weather or extreme cold weather fails in the hot weather months due to the aged and disabled population that we have at the home. Increases the chance of dehydration, and of course, in the winter months, it kind of speaks for itself, having the extreme cold weather and then the HVAC system failing as well. This is another project that is a 55% that can be covered by the VA and the one-third match from the state, but due to the urgency and the importance of what we have with this system, we're requesting 100% as well. During the governor's initiative, the projects that I had just described were the ones that were brought forward by the governor's initiative. However, there are some other projects that were not included. I'll go through those very briefly. The Hastings Supportive Housing Project, we were looking at a $6.6 million. That project is not covered by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs VA per diem program and would not fall under the one-third match for the state and two-thirds by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Fergus Falls Special Care Unit, that is a construction furnished a 21-bed special care unit for Alzheimer's dementia. The waiting list at Fergus Falls is 84. Their current census is 85, and their max census is 85, so they are pretty much right at their max capacity. And this is just to provide a better quality of life for residents or veterans that have dementia or Alzheimer's type disease.
And Commissioner, is that a total request or is that the matching dollar request for federal funding? And we have, by the way, Representative Norris and McNamara will be up here in a little bit to present these a little more depth, but do you know if the 9.9 is the total, like Minneapolis, you've asked for the total amount versus a matching amount, or is this matching?
That is the total amount here.
But they do qualify for...
The Kennedy Ojai Veterans Home construction project, $7.9 million, design, construct, furnish, equip a new 90-bed facility. The amount is the required match, the one-third match for the state. The two-thirds match will come from the federal government, again, providing a modern, state-of-the-art veterans home for our veterans in the state. Minneapolis security. Minneapolis campus security, install fully developed monitoring security system for the Minneapolis campus. This is to provide a safety for veterans that are at the state where they may start to wander, and in this system, it'll alert the staff more efficiently, such as if they go into an elevator, the elevator can actually lock down so that they won't go up and down in the elevator and elope from the facility. And then the Minneapolis Building 17, remodel all five units in the building to upgrade the kitchen and dining, which are much smaller and do not meet the required need for the residents that are there right now. That's an $11.35 million.
Does that qualify for matching dollars?
That does qualify for matching dollars as well.
But is this the full request or the matching request?
That is the full request.
Okay.
And that concludes my presentation of the bonding. I tried to move as quickly as I could.
Well, we appreciate that. And members, just to, again, this is new to us, but you're going to get very familiar with veterans projects and funding as we move forward because we have those budgets now. Building projects for long-term care and domiciliary
qualify for federal matching dollars for building them, a one-third state versus two-thirds federal. So you need to, once you're on the federal list and then we secure state dollars, then our folks here go out to Washington and try and move and hopefully do move those projects up the list for the federal dollars. So that is there. Now, there's obviously some inconsistency here on the request, and here's the problem from a fiscal standpoint, and you're a finance committee. When we fund right now the full amount, and we've done that in the past, 100%, we basically then use our bonding capacity for that. So, for example, the Minneapolis request at 30, or what was the request here? How much was the Minneapolis one?
26 million
for Minneapolis. So rather than a third of that, this is the full request. Now, then they'll go out to Washington, secure those dollars, they'll come back. The problem is with Ways and Means and our finance folks here, when it comes back, we don't get credit for that in bonding. We've used our bonding authority, comes back as a check, and goes into our general fund. And so as we account for these things, it makes it more difficult, is what I'm saying, for us to advocate for those projects, even though we are, because the bonding committee will look at it and say, man, we're trying to do bridges, Representative Magnus, we're trying to do all this, and you've got money you can get out of Washington, yet you want us to front it here, and we'll never get credit. We can't add another, you know, $15 million when that money comes back to our bonding authority next year. It just isn't accounted that way. And so fiscally, I believe, is one of the problems. And I'm looking at our fiscal guy at the end of the table. You got anything to add? Were you listening? Thank you. And then as we move forward to the other consideration, whether it's a new facility in Wilmer or Fergus or Hastings or any of the others, roughly, and it's not exact, but roughly, the state is on responsible for about half of the operations cost of that too. So it's not just simply adding a building, it's also planning for our fiscal tail 2 or 3 years down the line when these buildings come online. And so as a committee now, we start having to be aware of those budgets and start building them into our tails as we go forward. It's a good deal, we're getting money from the feds, but we also have to put in funds, as the commissioners know, and so that's their job to start planning and our job as a committee to understand if that's the direction we want to go. So with that, any questions to these projects that you heard now from the department? Representative Magnus.
I think the only exemption to that would be that if you don't increase the bed size or do things like that, you may not have as much of a tails on there. So
right.
I know what we did in Laverne and the veterans home there, we initially didn't add that, we took a didn't increase the count. So,
right.
But you're right, we have to be concerned about all
but
of that.
But I would also add that if they're not staying in a veterans home and they need long term care, they're probably staying somewhere else. And a lot of that is state tax dollars. So really, some of that is being shifted, if not all of it, and then getting the federal match dollars. I would argue on some cases we're saving money as we move forward, but again, we have to look across budgets on that because these folks are going to be cared for somewhere. Representative Powers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to clarify that in Minneapolis, one of the buildings, one of the homes that was housing 100 residents is now evacuated and going to be demolished, and so we need to replace those 100 beds someplace is what we're looking at, isn't that correct?
That building 9 actually was less, I believe it was 61 beds, and that's the one that the reason they're on the list is because this happened like last October, November. All of a sudden, we're faced with moving people out. So this was also the reason for asking for the funds now, because the VA list, there's a very complicated chart as to where you go as far as getting the reimbursement. So as you see, Silver Bay has been on there. It's number 37. It's moving along. Life safety puts you number one on the list. So it's life safety for moving the residents out of Building 9. And then this is an opportunity to move right to the top of the list. That is why we were asking for funding right now, because it would move to the top of the list. Otherwise, we've already moved people out of there. We don't have access to their beds. You can see what census is, and so it's a complicated issue. It truly is.
And members to Minneapolis, I'll make just an editorial comment. I have talked to a number of Minneapolis representatives, our colleagues, who have worked with this home for a number of years, and so, and we need to get out there as a committee too, and we'll try and do that so you all can see what's out there. It's a large campus. It's 53 acres. It's next to Minnehaha Park. It's one block from the light rail line. It's located across the street basically from the Federal Veterans Hospital out there, and so it's an interesting property. And but it's also an old historic property, and we have a lot of buildings out there that, like Building 9, are now deteriorating, and we're still responsible. It's all state property, and so we need to discover over the next year or two, especially as we move into the next budget cycle, and we're going to ask the department over the summer in particular to sit down with a lot of people and take another look at that campus. Sit down with the city of Minneapolis, where it's domiciled. Sit down with Veterans Affairs and Veterans Group. Sit down with other with the federal folks, and try and understand what the highest and best use of that campus might be. Because I think we have a lot of opportunities, not only for veterans services, but maybe for some public-private partnerships out there, and maybe for some other things beyond that. And so I think we're to the point where we're fresh eyes on this. We're a new look. The Veterans Homes Board is no more. It's now Veterans Affairs. We're the oversight committee, and I think not only for Minneapolis but for the entire system, what we're going to strive for is taking a look out and saying, how are we going to deliver these veteran services in the most cost-efficient way, but in the best way for the people we're serving, which are our clients, the veterans. So that will be coming, and Minneapolis is certainly going to take a real hard look at that going forward, again with the blessing of a lot of the Minneapolis legislators who represent and have worked with that facility for a number of years.
And Chair, I would like to point out there are a lot of people present from the Veterans Service Organization. If you are looking with fresh eyes, believe me, they want to weigh in.
Yep.
And they are looking for an opportunity to weigh in.
We expect them to, Commissioner.
I just want to bring that to your
We might order them to. They understand right. that they're in the military, so we're going to order you to weigh in, all right? But no, we will work with you, and we want everyone to go out in this entire system, whether it's Fergus Falls or Laverne or Silver Bay or Hastings. We want to go out with a fresh set of eyes and understand how we can best utilize these facilities and future facilities and services out there for our clients, and that's our goal in this committee. So, all right, thank you very much. What did I miss? Okay, Candia County, I'll quickly present mine and why I'm doing that. Ward, you can come up because I'm not going to take very long. Candia County, members, is a 90-bed unit. It was started, the process started a number of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. A census was done, which is the first thing you do. There's a need. It's not within a two-hour drive of any other facility. It has been put on the federal funding list. It's number 150, I believe, but it's going to stay there until the state makes a commitment, and then it starts moving at that point. That's how these work. The pre-design, we already gave money to it two bonding cycles ago, or 3 years ago. The year we did a bonding bill, that wasn't a bonding year. They got money for it, so the pre-design is all done. It's ready to go that way. Essentially, it's sitting there ready to go. And it was a decision made by the old Veterans Home Board to pursue this. It's in place, and we think it's time that we move forward. I don't think it should wait another 2 years. I'm the author of the bill, obviously. That's personal opinion, but everything's ready to go. Unlike, you know, a lot of the things we see, this one is ready to go. So the Wilmer facility, by the way, is 90 beds. It's set up in the new mod type design. There would be six 15-bed units, and those units then could be retrofitted to other needs. We heard a testimony the other day about TBI in this committee a month or a month and a half ago. We could literally set up a veterans clinic or research facility for TBI out there in one of those pods if we needed to. If we needed to retrofit a pod for long-term care for our returning Iraqi vets, we could do that. And we're going to insist on that on new projects, too, when we do it, that we're very flexible because we have changing demographics with veterans. We're serving World War II and Korean War vets now. We have a whole flush of Korean and World War II now. We have a whole flush of Vietnam vets that are coming. We have thousands of Iraqi and Afghani vets returning to the state over the last few years that we're going to have to take care of over the next decades. And so we have to be more flexible in what we do and not get locked into a certain design or a certain type of care. And I think that's our challenge, too. The Wilmer Project and hopefully the Fergus Project, Representative Nornes, will have that flexibility as we add on or we build new, and that's what we're going to request from new facilities. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Chair Junkie, and members.
Well, my bill will just be laid over again till tomorrow, and it'll probably be the vehicle. And right now we have Representative Ward's bill, which is what? House File 2456. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Junkie, and committee members. Representative John Ward, here talking about the House File 2456, along with Shea Haverkamp from the Brainerd Lakes Area Economic Development Authority, who will talk briefly about what we have available up there. And I'm glad that you talked about new facilities. And Representative Faust, you raised the point about Minneapolis closing down, looking at another 100 beds plus in the state. My House File 2456 is simply a $500,000 bonding request for planning design money to look at expansion of our VA. We have a VA clinic in Brainerd on the Regional Treatment Center site, and we want to expand from the VA clinic into a potential VA veterans nursing home or nursing home facility or nursing home, less care. What did you call that, Representative Junkie?
Domiciliary
care, correct. And so knowing that Brainerd, or Crow Wing County, outside the metro area, we have in the state of Minnesota, we have the second largest number of veterans in our county. St. Louis County, outside the metro, is number one, and then we are number two. We have a huge number of veterans in Crow Wing County. And so with that, we want to look future to the future also for planning for our veterans and facilities that we could have for them. Saying that, I'm gonna turn over to Sheila to talk to you about what we do have in our region treatment center and the availability of what we could do out there to use this planning design money.
And again, members, regional treatment centers have been reconfigured, and they're going through a downsizing. Obviously, Wilmer was in that boat and still is, along with Brainerd. In the past, we've revamped Moose Lake into something. We've been struggling with Fergus Falls for years. So we've got these state facilities out here, and that's why Representative Ward is here searching for another use for that facility and for those jobs up there. But please, introduce yourself for the tape.
Well, thank you, Chair Junkie. I'm Sheila Haverkamp, and I work, like Representative Ward said, with the Brainerd Lakes Area Development Corporation, and I've actually been there for 20 years. I'm celebrating my 20-year anniversary. So I've watched the economic development history of our community. And, of course, one of the changes that has occurred is the regional treatment centers. And at peak employment, that facility employed more than 600 people, in fact, 680, almost 700 people. And today, we're going to be going below the 200 employee mark with the recent consolidation of that child behavioral to the Wilmer facility. And just to give you a sense of the need for jobs in our community, when Minnesota Care decided to open up a processing center in our community, they advertised 35 job openings, and we had more than 1,500 people apply. And they said they'd never seen that kind of a turnout before. And the Brainerd Regional Human Service Center is, as I understand, one of the last regional treatment centers to go through a reuse planning process. And we engaged the community as well as several consultants and experts to help us look with where the site is located in our community and what opportunities exist for reuse. And medical care came to the top as a type of reuse that made a lot of sense. And as a result, we are very interested in the veterans' services as part of that campus. We have a 127-acre site, that is not being utilized to its capacity and has a lot of infrastructure systems. It's currently state-owned, and we see serving the veterans as a key component of the reuse of that property. And so we thank you for any consideration that you can give as you look to provide funds and programs and services for these individuals.
Very good. Good to know what's out there. Any questions for Representative Ward or his witness? All right. Representative Ward, your bill 2456 was moved by me and will be laid over for possible inclusion tomorrow in the bill we put out of here.
Thank you, Chair Duffy and committee members.
Representative Thiessen. Chair, I'll move House File 3098 before the committee for possible inclusion in a bill to go out of this body tomorrow. Welcome to the committee, Representative Thiessen. Looks like you got some friends with you here.
We do.
Visual aids. We like visual aids. Very nice.
I'll get started if you
yes,
want to.
Please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will let these guys speak most of the time. This is a little different project than you've heard about today. Today actually is the anniversary of the landing at Iwo Jima. And as many of you know, Richfield resident and Minnesota hero Chuck Lindbergh was one of the folks that raised the flag a few days later during that battle. We're here today to present you with what I think is a very exciting proposal for an honoring all veterans memorial to be located in Richfield. It will feature Mr. Lindbergh, but it really is to honor all veterans from all branches, all eras, and from across the state for their service. And I think you'll hear a little bit about the excitement that this has generated among veterans statewide, among labor groups, business groups. It's really been an exciting project to watch develop. What we're asking for is $200,000 in state dollars. They put a financing plan to privately raise $500,000, but to complete the project, as you see it in the visual there, we need an extra $200,000, and so that's what our request is for. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Topic Toffer from the City of Richfield to explain the project a bit more.
Welcome to the committee. We got a tape running, so introduce yourself for the tape so that our non-visual people later will know who we're talking to, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Junty. Committee members, my name is Jim Topitzofer. I'm the Parks and Recreation Director for the City of Richfield. I'm also a board member of the Honoring All Veterans Memorial Incorporated. On behalf of the City of Richfield, I'm grateful to present the Honoring All Veterans Memorial. This project was developed through the efforts of the Richfield Arts Commission and a talented artist, person on my left, Travis Gorshi, who had the passion to honor the memory of United States military veterans from all military branches and the vision to provide a place for people all over the state of Minnesota to reflect upon and thank those who have served. Travis and I, along with some of the members you see here behind us, have formed a nonprofit organization for the purposes of raising funds for this worthy project and to build a memorial in Veterans Memorial Park, which is located on Portland Avenue, very close to the west border of MSP Airport. Another thing our group is doing is overseeing the construction, which has begun already, and ultimately donating this back to the City of Richfield so that the City of Richfield can take care of it for years to come so that all can enjoy it. We've been a group for just a little over a year, and we've raised well over $140,000, just a small group of us already, and are on our way to making this a reality. Our total project cost is $700,000, and the main source of funding comes from the sale of engravings that we incorporate into the design. We have about 10 tablets starting out with, each tablet with about 100 names that people can sponsor the name of a veteran as a way to honor them, included right in this memorial. The names of all veterans are welcome on the memorial, active or retired, wartime or peacetime, full services or reserves, deceased or living, and regardless of where they live. And we've got the capacity to receive thousands of more names.
And you can see the tablets in your drawing there behind them.
We have the range that we've received in names so far. We have a Civil War veterans, and it goes all the way up to present time veterans. The construction of our memorial is well underway. We're happy about that. Our first milestone was selecting a large rock to mount our statue with Chuck Lindbergh on. And we found a 13-ton taconite boulder from the Cleveland Cliff Mine in Eveleth that was the perfect size and the perfect shape to receive this statue. And that achieved our goal of representing the rich heritage of Minnesota mining industry into our monument. We've also contracted an artist to complete a bronze statue of Chuck Lindbergh, and we've completed drawings and specs and are planning on building the centerpiece pedestal with the statue and unveiling it this summer. We've also received a lot of help from the IBEW 292 and other union trade organizations, and we're pleased with that help because that's helping to reduce the cost of the overall cost of the memorial. And we couldn't ask for any better people to work with. I just want to leave you with two points here before I turn it over to Travis. One is we feel pretty strong that this is a regional project and not a city project, and I'll explain why. As I mentioned, we've received over 240 names already to be put on the memorial, and most of those names are from people living outside of Richfield. They come from the metro area, from all over the state. So that really demonstrates the notoriety of Chuck Lindbergh and what he meant to the state of Minnesota. It also shows that there's a need to be able to permanently display names of veterans as a way to really thank them forever. We anticipate the percentage of non-Richfield names to increase as the construction continues. The second point that I wanted to make here today is that we believe that our project design and concept sells itself because we've sold so many engravings already without even having anything physically there. Now this summer we're going to put the pedestal there. What we really need from the state of Minnesota is to be able to put out more tangible items in our memorial so that it can sustain itself funding-wise through this future sale of engraving. And that's what our request is all about. We need a jump start from you to help us really finish this job. All right. I'm going to introduce Travis Gorshi, our artist, and he's going to give you a better understanding of our project design and elements.
Hey, you got about 2 minutes, and then I got two more projects to get out of here before we get to the noon floor session. So welcome to the committee. Take as much time as you want, under 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman Junkie and committee members. I'll be real brief. I just want to talk in two parts. First of who the...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Travis Gorshi. I'm the designer and founder of the Honoring All Veterans Memorial.
Thank you.
February 2005 is when I started this project, so 3 years ago. I approached Charles Lindbergh and told him we would like to do a memorial on him. The first thing he stated to me was, please don't make it about me, make it about all veterans. And I said, that's exactly what we'll do, but we'd like to tell your story. Mr. Lindbergh was a veteran of the United States Marine Corps. He was involved in three amphibious landings, Guadalcanal, Bougainville, and also Iwo Jima. He raised the first flag that went up on Iwo Jima on the fifth day after the landing on the 23rd of February. That's 6 days after that is when he got shot and wounded. He ended up in a hospital in Guam when the newspaper came out and someone said, hey, would you want to see the first flag going up on Japanese soil? Turned out to be the second flag raising. He was called a liar for many years, and he's determined to continue to educate people about the first flag. He moved to Richfield, where he was a resident for 53 years. He joined the IBEW Local 292, where he retired. He was also recognized in the movie Flag of Our Fathers that came out in six different areas by verbal and visual recognition.
This passed in June of 2007. Mr. Lindbergh passed away due to health reasons, 2 days short of his 87th birthday. He was a very close friend of mine. I still stay in contact with his widow, Vi, and the rest of his family. His funeral was one of the largest funeral processions in the state of Minnesota. It had over 300 cars that went in and 12 different law enforcement agencies worked as the motorcycle brigade. He also, on the worldwide internet, was the number one story for 2 days after his death. There were many reports and stories written about him, including the country of Japan did a dedicated story about Charles Lindbergh. So that just really goes to show the significance. I just want to touch base on a couple points on the memorial, the significance of the design to our veterans and also to the state of Minnesota. The memorial itself is in a 60-foot diameter, which takes into consideration the Native American circle of life and its four points of direction. It has six 15-foot high concrete and granite tablets that curve inwards towards the flag. Those represent the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Merchant Marines, and Coast Guard. They bend inwards to significant to show that it's our armed services can bend but don't break, and their common goal is the American flag. Between the north, or between the east and west columns, is a glass dial. This is in theory that at sunrise and sunset, a spectrum of light will shine across our memorial in honor of a full day service to our Marines, or to our servicemen and women. This would make it the first interactive memorial in the United States. Also, the final part of it, which will go ahead and be the granite tablets that are outside of the dials. There's five on the east and five on the west. We will continue to add rows of tablets throughout the years, eventually going five and five, then four and six, three and seven, two and eight, one and nine, and a row of 10. And coming in from a westbound approach into the international airport, if you were to look down to yourself, you would see a lighted teardrop for tears of joy and tears of sorrow for our veterans, our Minnesota veterans, is what the completed design would look like. I want to say thank you to you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for giving us the chance to give a presentation, and be happy to answer any questions.
Good. Well, thank you for that, and I appreciate the explanation of the design. I appreciate the Native American influence, too. As we know in this committee, and the commissioner mentions a lot, they volunteer and rate 2-1 to the rest of the population. So it's important that we include that asset whenever we can. Any questions, members? If not, thank you, Representative Thiessen, and your bill will be laid over for possible inclusion tomorrow.
Thanks a lot.
Representative McNamara, you've been humming around up here. Come on down. And then you're next, Nornis. Ready to go. We'll get you to the floor in time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I bring forward the Hastings Supportive Housing, and with me is Administrator Chip Cox.
Members, the chair will move House File 864 before the committee for possible inclusion. Go ahead.
You've got a lot of great background, Mr. Chair. It was number two in the original Veterans Home Board ranking, and I will let Mr. Cox give you about 1 minute of background, and we'll stand for questions.
All right. Mr. Cox, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Chip Cox. Charles Cox, I was baptized as, but I go by Chip Cox. I'm the administrator of the Hastings Veterans Home. In Hastings, we're a domiciliary care facility. We have 200 beds for veterans out there, requiring numerous different types of care. The average age of our resident living in the facility is 56. Some residents are short-stay residents who come to the veterans' home to address their needs and then try to return to the community. Unfortunately, there is a shortage of safe, sober, and affordable housing available to them. So many return to undesirable living situations, either with a friend, a family, shelters, or become homeless. Many get caught in a revolving door situation, first to the crisis center, then to the hospital, to rehab, and then back to a long-term care facility. In addition, the success of a discharge is dependent to a large extent on the supportive services that are available to assist the veteran in their transition. In the continuum, a permanent supportive housing program is affordable housing with no time limits and with services that allow the veteran
to be successful in their community setting. The goal of this supportive housing program is to keep the veteran living with quality and purpose in an independent setting. Supportive housing provides services the resident or the tenant would choose from an a la carte list of services that they would require. The program is a two-phase program. The first phase includes 30 one-bedroom apartments, and a second phase to follow of an additional 30 units. Total cost of the first phase is $6.6 million. It would build a 30,000 square foot apartment building. 18,000 square feet of that would be set aside for tenant space, and there would be common areas of the other 12,000. All buildings would be handicapped accessible and would be suitable to perhaps women, which we haven't thought about in the past, with children. We may need to be flexible in how the apartments are set up and how we care for those people that come into our home, into our facility. I think that's all I can say in a minute.
All right. Well, very good. And we do understand the need for housing. That's one of our big needs in the state for veterans. And we're trying, again, to discover how we can go about answering that. And I've seen the plans. The committee, bonding committee, has seen them. So we hope we can get your bill up there so you get some consideration, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr.
Any questions, members? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nornes. Save the best for last. Members, Representative Nornes is going to make a motion on the floor to get that bill from Mary Ellen Otremba's committee over to Al Junkie's committee, because for some reason our crack staff sent it down to the wrong committee. But motion will be waiting for you. Our committee administrator called it in, and Representative Otremba, I assume he's got the okay of both people to do that on the floor. Are we going to talk about it? Okay, you're in good shape.
Okay, all right.
So I will not move that bill, but we'll certainly consider it, and if we do an amendment tomorrow on all the bills, it'll be in there.
Okay, so. Well, I appreciate that. Appreciate this late hour for hanging in there for me. Mr. Chair, you have seen the project, and so you kind of have an idea of what I'm talking about. I get invitations from the residents at the Fergus Falls Veterans Nursing Home at least twice a year, one for the veterans dinner, the pheasant dinner, and the venison dinner. Venison dinner is actually coming up this Friday. So it's quite a fun time for everybody to get together. And at the last pheasant dinner, I promised that I would go full tilt to get this project done. So that's why I'm here. It's not up to me entirely, but I'm asking for your assistance here a little bit. I won't go through a lot of detail since it was actually mentioned earlier in your meeting what this project's all about. It is a special care unit. This facility is very unique. It's one of the new homes, so it's up to date as far as the way it's designed, and adding this 21-bed unit fits in very well with the original architecture. And this facility also has a clinic. If you're not aware of that, it's the very first nurse practitioner nursing home based VA clinic in the nation. And so we're making good use of the facility, and the veterans really appreciate that. And I guess in closing, say we can't do enough for the veterans. And so I urge your continued support. This didn't quite make the governor's recommendation, but you know, he's just the governor. Right.
Thank you for that comment. The tape's still running, right? All right. Well, we appreciate that, Representative Nornes. And for those that haven't been to Fergus, I'm sure you're always invited to stop in when you're down the freeway that way. And it is a home that everyone should tour, because it is set up like the design we'd like to see a lot of these future facilities have. It's a very unique Main Street type design with the barber shops and the dining room area. And
it incorporates a lot of the home features that people expect. I should also add that it's built on part of the campus of the Regional Treatment Center, so we're utilizing some of that state property, and it fits in very nice with that campus.
All right. Very good. Any questions on this, members? All right. If not, Representative Shemansky moves the minutes. from, where's the date here?
March 27th.
March 28th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. Those minutes are adopted. Members, we are adjourned.